All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? Oh, well, good. All right, then. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And for 2 hours today, I'm going to sit here and tell you that I don't know what happened to that plane either. Yeah, I'm going to do my best CNN impression. Well, so there's this plane that had a bunch of people on it, and nobody knows where it is now. And I'm going to say that over and over and over again for 2 hours. You might as well just turn off the show now. See, there was this plane. And then it kind of disappeared, and nobody's quite sure where it went. There was a plane. It took off from a place, but never got to where it was supposed to go. But then they can't seem to find it, you know, wreckage in the ocean either. Okay, I'm done. Sorry. All day long on CNN. That's all they'll talk about. I turned to CNN International. I thought, well, at least tell me about the damn soccer scores. No. And nothing but, I don't care about soccer scores. I don't even, they call it football everywhere else but here. Anyway. They're not even doing the weather report. Nothing but the missing plane. Which, hey, you know, missing plane. It's kind of a, you know, first of all, it's a big story and it's kind of an interesting story, but the fact that there's no news other than, well, now they're saying they think maybe it turned around and got lost in an entirely different place than they thought before. Okay, that's kind of a development, but gotta sell that dish soap, man. I wonder how they do that. Do they have, like, a sliding scale with their advertisers, where the advertisers know that we could jack up your rates, even, like, ex post facto, when we find out the ratings? We can jack up your rates in real time, all day long. If there's breaking news, we'll charge you double for your dish soap ad or your tires commercial or what. How does that work? I wonder if I can get a sliding scale like that. But anyway, so all airplane crash, all day. Not that there's anything else in the world that you need to know about. I think CNN is here. All right, well, I'm here. So, Dianne Feinstein, man, here in a minute, I'm going to play for you a speech that she gave to the U.S. Senate. Now, there's some that don't happen every day on the show. You may be familiar with the fact that Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that she's got a reputation of being pretty damn good on torture. I don't know if she's perfect on it or anything, but she's pretty good on torture. And, of course, she's horrible on spying. But she's pretty good on torture. Well, now she's found herself spied on. And her staff. Well, her staff, but same difference. So, we're going to be talking about that. I'm going to be playing for you her speech. I think this is really important kind of, you know, American history being written kind of a thing here. Not just news, but really noteworthy. Her talk to the U.S. Senate this morning. And then Jacob Hornberger is going to be on the show from the Future Freedom Foundation to talk about what it all means. And then guess what? Our old friend Dar Jamail is going to be on the show because he's written a new piece about Fallujah and the Maliki government's renewed war there. So we'll have plenty to talk about. Boy, it'll be just like old times, right? Dar Jamail on the show to talk about the war in Fallujah going on right now. That's coming up later on here in a minute. Let me just mention real quick, because I won't have time. You can follow Jason Leopold on Twitter. He's talking about, our good friend Andy Worthington as well. Both of them talking today about how the Pentagon has renamed hunger strikes, you know, for the 12th edition of the new Speak Dictionary coming out. Hunger strikes are now called long-term non-religious fasts, right? Like weapons of mass destruction related program activities. You know, like kinetic action. Long-term non-religious fasts. Okay, good. And then I got in a fight with a friend about the NSA the other day. Well, about other topics as well. And one of the things that came up was the Bill of Rights and this common misunderstanding that the Bill of Rights is a Bill of Rights, which I guess it sort of kind of is, but not really. And I don't just mean that it's defunct and there's nothing in there that our government is bound to respect any longer. I don't mean that, but I mean the premise of the damn thing. Go and, in fact, just put in your Google search for the Bill of Rights, and a lot of the times, not most of the time, but a lot of the times, you can find the preamble to the Bill of Rights. And what it says is that, well, a lot of the states didn't want to ratify the Constitution unless James Madison promised them that their first order of business would be to add a Bill of Rights to it. And so that's what it did, in order to instill greater confidence in the new government. The following declaratory and restrictive clauses shall be added to it, it says. So, in other words, the Bill of Rights is not a gift of liberty from your divine creator, the U.S. state. It is presumed to be a natural right of yours from your divine creator, God, or nature, or whatever you believe in, self-evident to us all. We are all naturally born with a property right to our own life, and therefore our own liberty, etc. And so therefore, in this society, government shall be forever forbidden. They are expressly denied authority to ever violate the right of the people to freely associate, to say what they want, to pick their own belief system and method of practicing it, to be free of any, you know, attempted state imposition along those lines, to be free in their houses, to have the right to bear arms, to have the right to due process if they're accused of the kind of crime that could get them stripped of their liberty by the rest of society or the state in the rest of society's name, etc. So this is not a promise from the state to us. It's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be a list of rules that we place on them. And so, that being said, you could see in context then how no argument, for example, for the National Security Agency's surveillance powers can possibly be good enough. Even if they really did stop 54 attacks, even if they really did stop one, but even if they did stop 54 attacks, they just do not have the authority to do it. That's all. They, by definition, must be breaking the law in order to collect this mass surveillance data on all of us. And so, as Edward Snowden put it yesterday, they changed it from no unreasonable search and seizure to go ahead and seize it, but just don't search it. Unless you have a reason to. And then, of course, the reason is not probable cause. The reason, then, is a reasonable belief on the part of somebody whose decisions will never be checked by any independent authority. And it's the rubber stamp FISA court that actually doesn't even, or maybe they do still grant individual warrants, but mostly now they're in the process of rubber stamping warrants, general warrants, for entire categories of information. And all of that kind of thing. So I thought that was a good thing, the way he put that yesterday. But so, you know, and I don't mean to like sit here and try to teach junior high to you or whatever about the Bill of Rights, but I think people really don't understand this that much. And maybe it's just because it's a bad title. It should be called the List of Restrictions, not the Bill of Rights, the List of Restrictions, and not the List of Restrictions on us, the List of Restrictions by us. James Madison, yeah, but in our name. And so that's why, look at the language. Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor of speech, the press, the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition their government for a redress of grievances, right? The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, oath, or affirmation, particular describing the place to be searched, persons, things to be seized, and on, right? It doesn't say you have the right to carry a gun because the Founding Fathers decided that they would let you. Okay? It acknowledges that free men, of course, have the right to protect their own lives and the lives of other innocents with lethal force. And so, therefore, that is a right that may not be infringed by this new government that a bunch of armed free men are allowing to exist. Not that everyone under its jurisdiction was free, you understand, but the people who were at the conventions who ratified the damn thing were. So, all right. Man, music's about to play. We got to go out to break. When we get back, Feinstein, and then, man, I never have enough time to cover everything I want to cover on the show. But we will have another half hour at the end of the show, actually, too, to catch up. But we're going to talk Victoria Nuland and Ukraine and CIA Senate and Free Barrett and Syria. And Patrick Coburn's got a new one. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Jacob Hornberger's coming up in just a few. And we're going to be talking about this. This is Dianne Feinstein before the U.S. Senate today. Again, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Well, here, let me give you a little bit of background. It's McClatchy Newspapers has been all over this. McClatchyDC.com. Jonathan Landay, etc. And the story is that, of course, there's this 6,300-page report on the CIA torture program that's been put together by Feinstein's staff. And they want to release it, but the FBI, the CIA has created a fake scandal over, you know, arguing points of fact, which is just a delaying tactic, trying to prevent the thing from being released. And in this context, some Senate staffers were at Langley, Virginia, on what were supposed to be, you know, quote-unquote, their computers, but at CIA headquarters going through stuff. They found some, they found the Panetta Report, which is basically an internal CIA report on their own torture program, which verified, which basically corroborated the Senate staff's view rather than the objections of the CIA themselves about what the staff's report says. And so they took the report that the CIA had, you know, denied existed, I guess, or had not given them, and they took it back with them to Capitol Hill to do their work. And then the CIA ratted on themselves. The only way that the CIA could have known this was by spying on their computers and completely violating the separation of powers and spying on the Senate staff. And then, but they went and ratted on themselves anyway. And they went and notified the Senate Intelligence Committee, your staff stole these documents. But the only way they could have known that was by completely violating the law and stepping way outside of their, you know, acceptable jurisdiction, whatever, and spying on their own oversight committee in a big fight over whether to release their report, the Senate report about the CIA torturing approximately 100 people and some of them to death in their custody back in the Bush CIA torture program. So, here's Dianne Feinstein, a very important speech. It runs about 8 minutes.
Other questions related to who had authorized and conducted the search and what legal basis the CIA claimed gave it authority to conduct the search. Again, the CIA has not provided answers to any of my questions. My letter also laid out my concern about the legal and constitutional implications of the CIA's actions. Based on what Director Brennan has informed us, I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution, including the speech and debate clause. It may have undermined the constitutional framework essential to effective congressional oversight of intelligence activities or any other government function. I have asked for an apology and a recognition that this CIA search of computers used by its oversight committee was inappropriate. I have received neither. Besides the constitutional implication, the CIA search may also have violated the Fourth Amendment, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as Executive Order 12333, which prohibits the CIA from conducting domestic searches or surveillance. Days after the meeting with Director Brennan, the CIA Inspector General, David Buckley, learned of the CIA search and began an investigation into CIA's activities. I have been informed that Mr. Buckley has referred the matter to the Department of Justice, given the possibility of a criminal violation by CIA personnel. Let me note, because the CIA has refused to answer the questions in my January 23rd letter, and the CIA Inspector General is ongoing, I have limited information about exactly what the CIA did in conducting its search. Weeks later, I was also told that after the Inspector General reviewed the CIA's activities to the Department of Justice, referred the CIA's activities to the Department of Justice, the Acting Counsel General of the CIA filed a crimes report with the Department of Justice concerning the committee staff's actions. I have not been provided the specifics of these allegations or been told whether the department has initiated a criminal investigation based on the allegations of the CIA's acting general counsel. As I mentioned before, our staff involved in this matter got the appropriate clearances, handled this sensitive material according to established procedures and practice to protect classified information, and were provided access to the Panetta review by the CIA itself. As a result, there is no legitimate reason to allege to the Justice Department that Senate staff may have committed a crime. I view the Acting Consul General's referral as a potential effort to intimidate this staff, and I am not taking it lightly. I should note that for most, if not all, of the CIA's detention and interrogation program, the now acting general counsel was a lawyer in the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, the unit within which the CIA managed and carried out this program. From mid-2004 until the official termination of the detention and interrogation program in January 2009, he was the unit's chief lawyer. He is mentioned by name more than 1,600 times in our study. And now this individual is sending a crimes report to the Department of Justice on the actions of congressional staff, the same congressional staff who researched and drafted a report that details how CIA officers, including the acting general counsel himself, provided inaccurate information to the Department of Justice about the program. Mr. President, let me say this. All senators rely on their staff to be their eyes and ears and to carry out our duties. The staff members of the Intelligence Committee are dedicated professionals who are motivated to do what is best for our nation. The staff members who have been working on this study and this report have devoted years of their lives to it, wading through the horrible details of a CIA program that never, never, never should have existed. They have worked long hours and produced a report unprecedented in its comprehensive attention to detail in the history of the Senate. They are now being threatened with legal jeopardy, just as the final revisions to the report are being made, so that parts of it can be declassified and released to the American people. Mr. President, I felt that I needed to come to the floor today to correct the public record and to give the American people the facts about what the dedicated committee staff have been working so hard for the last several years as part of the committee's investigation. I also want to reiterate to my colleagues my desire to have all updates to the committee report completed this month and approved for declassification. We're not going to stop. I intend to move to have the findings, conclusions, and the executive summary of the report sent to the President for declassification and release to the American people. The White House has indicated publicly, and to me personally, that it supports declassification and release. If the Senate can declassify this report, we will be able to ensure that an un-American, brutal program of detention and interrogation will never again be considered or permitted. But, Mr. President, the recent actions that I have just laid out make this a defining moment for the Oversight Intelligence Committee. How Congress and how this will be resolved will show whether the Intelligence Committee can be effective in monitoring and investigating our nation's intelligence activities, or whether our work can be thwarted by those we oversee. I believe it is critical that the committee and the Senate reaffirm our oversight role and our independence under the Constitution of the United States. Mr. President, I thank you very much for your patience, and I yield the floor.
Mr. President.
All right, there you go. So that was Dianne Feinstein, Senator from California, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, on the floor of the Senate this morning, complaining about, and I hope you caught the good part there. I realize it's almost 8 minutes long there. Maybe it's hard to pick out. The most important part of what was going on there is the CIA, and as she points out, an individual who is a major player in what the report reports on, and that is the CIA's criminal torture program. That very same individual is the one who is trying to file a criminal complaint with the Justice Department against the Senate staff for liberating the Panetta report from the CIA and bringing it back to Capitol Hill. This supposedly is a violation of their agreement with the CIA about, what document, according to the CIA, it's a violation of that agreement. About what they're supposed to take. But as Feinstein says in there, they're the ones who gave the Panetta report to the staff in the first place. I don't know if she was exactly conceding that maybe they didn't have permission to remove it from Langley or not. I don't, I think that still is up in the air. But the point being, of course, that in the scheme of things, the way it's supposed to work is that the CIA is Congress's little bitch. The CIA is not supposed to be the boss of the Congress. The Congress allowed the CIA into existence. The Senate Intelligence Committee has every right to any document that they want from the CIA, and the CIA has the right and the obligation to cry, "Yes, master," period. Not to spy on the Senate staff and then try to refer them over to criminal investigation to the Department of Justice. Thank God Dianne Feinstein is finally pissed about something the government is doing for a change. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, you all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Welcome back to the show. Jacob, how are you doing?
Doing great. Nice to be back. Always an honor, Scott.
All right. Good times. Very happy to have you here and happy to have the opportunity to thank you again for having me out to your conference within a conference at the International Students for Liberty thing back on February the 15th. The video is at your YouTube channel and mine. It's called Libertarian, John Glazer and Scott Horton, Libertarianism versus the Empire. And I'm a little disjointed at the beginning because I just showed up at the hotel when it was time for my speech to be over. I think it turned out all right. And so, but anyway, I had a great time and I got to hang out with Bob Higgs and Sheldon Richmond and everybody, Gareth Porter and all that. So it was really great. And thank you again for having me out there, Jacob.
Oh, the thanks are ours, Scott. Your talk was absolutely awesome. I mean, it was chaotic, as you know, your flight got canceled and you had to come in at the last minute, but it turned out to be fantastic. I'm glad we got it fit in. And on our website at fff.org, we now have all the videos posted for our conference within a conference, and they're all just fantastic. I mean, of course, the big one was the Oliver Stone panel, mm-hmm. From what I understand, that the videos of that panel have received more than 17,000 views on YouTube.
Great.
But all the talks, your talk, Glazer's, Stephen Kinzer, Jamil Jaffer, Jonathan Turley, and they were just fantastic. Sheldon Richmond and I did a libertarian angle.
Yep.
So I invite everybody to go in there and go to fff.org and just attend the conference. Even though it's over, you can still attend it by watching all these fantastic lectures.
Right, yeah, I really like Stephen Kinzer. He's my favorite.
Oh, he's awesome. Just absolutely awesome. And his speech was just fantastic. It was dynamic, enthusiastic, informative, principled. It was just fantastic.
All right, so now, I got the idea, and a friend emailed me to say that he thinks I'm right, so I must be right, that this news is not news. This news is world history. This is huge. This is major. This is sort of kind of like a 9/11 sort of a pivot point, a spot where you turn the page in your history book in a few decades from now. I think this fight between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA over the 6,300-page Senate torture report, Intel Committee torture report on the CIA's torture program that the CIA has been fighting to keep classified and picking, I think, what's pretty obviously bogus fights over the details in order to try to keep it classified. And now the lengths that they have gone to in spying on the Senate staff, as reported in McClatchy newspapers, and attempting to file criminal charges with the Department of Justice against the Senate staff for liberating a CIA, what's called the Panetta Report, that actually corroborates the Senate's report rather than the CIA's objections to the Senate's report. And Dianne Feinstein gave a speech this morning on the floor of the Senate where she said she took the filing or attempted filing or complaining official the lodging of an official complaint to the Department of Justice by the CIA as an attempt of intimidation against her and her staff and her committee. And she was not going to take it lying down. And have you ever seen such a thing in your life?
Well, I've been saying for a long time now that the national security state apparatus, which consists of the Pentagon, the vast military-industrial complex, the military empire, the CIA, and the NSA, have effectively become a fourth branch of government. And it is the most powerful branch. It is more powerful than the executive, the judicial, and the congressional branch. And so here you have the CIA actually requiring the members of the Senate staffers, to come over to CIA headquarters to look at files because the CIA said, we're not going to come over there with our files. So, you know, like, who is serving in the subservient position? It's clear to me that the Senate is serving the subservient position to this fourth branch of government. And then what happens is some of these staffers find out that the CIA has lied to Congress about all this torture, and they apparently take out some of the documents showing that. And the CIA discovers this by surreptitiously spying on the computer systems of Congress. And, of course, you know, the congressmen are just blasé about this, nonchalant. I mean, it's like they have accepted their subservient role until some of us started raising questions. Connor Spriedersdorf wrote a great piece on this. Mm-hmm. Other people have written about it. And finally, Dianne Feinstein, it's like a light bulb goes off in her head and says, oh, my gosh, they're not supposed to do this. And so she gives this little speech about how outraged she is that the CIA is spying on Congress and she wants this investigation. But this deference to the CIA and the national security state on the part of Congress, it's gone on for a long time, Scott. This is nothing new. It's inconsistent with what the founders of this country had in mind, but it's certainly nothing new.
Yeah, you know, I think part of the thing, part of the problem that ails us is that there's so much secrecy surrounding it that, you know, we find kind of, you know, shafts of light peeking through the darkness occasionally where, you know, even in the Washington Post, right, Dana Priest and William Arkin did that series that became a book about Top Secret America, where they basically describe the national security state and the military-industrial complex and that whole web as, you know, doubling or tripling even since 9/11, right? The growth from World War II to 9/11 was X, and then since then is X times 3. Right. And yet it's all in secrecy. And so you really can get away with just waving a flag and making believe that we have our three branches and the big white marble structures of D.C. that represent them. And this whole top secret America is still kind of in the shadows. And so we don't really have much of a grasp of how much has changed until then we see something like this where, wow, man, so the CIA really thinks they're big shots compared to the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, huh? That's interesting, right?
Oh, it's fascinating. But it is very revealing because it shows their mindset and it exposes the charade of what's gone on for this for decades. As a quote democratic system, I mean you've got what some people call the deep state, or some people would call it the parallel state. So you have the what we see on the surface, you know, what we learn in the civics classes in high school and in college and so forth, where we have three branches of government and they're separation of powers and they balance off against each other and this is to, you know, blah blah blah. But underneath the surface, you have the deep state, the parallel state, that is engaged in assassinations, it's unlimited power, torture, disappearances of people, supporting brutal dictators, renditions. And none of us are permitted to know about that. And as you point out, every so often, some of it leaks to the surface. And everybody looks at it like, oh, my gosh, put it underneath there, put it underneath. And that's what the CIA is trying to do with this torture report. You know, keep it secret. The American people don't need to know about this. Same with the NSA. They have this super secret surveillance scheme. They don't want Americans to understand that the government's spying on them. They want this little aura of what's on top of the surface of democracy and three branches of government, when, in fact, you've got a totalitarian apparatus that is spying on people, that is torturing people, assassinating people, that is consistent with everything the Soviet Union, the communist regimes were consistent with. And so is it refreshing to see Dianne Feinstein say, hey, you're the servant, you serve us. Yeah, but I don't think anything's going to come of this. No, nobody's going to get arrested or indicted or punished. We won't even learn the names of the CIA agents who did the spying. Right. You know, to me, it's just a tempest in a teapot, but at least it does expose how powerful this branch of government has become.
Right. And plus, it's just nice to see her mad, too. You know.
Well, yeah, unless it's just fake indignation. You never know
right.
about these people. And you really don't even know how many assets the CIA has in Congress. So they're not required to report that. We don't know whether they have assets there. They have assets everywhere else. within the press and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'll be real interested to see what comes of this, but my prediction is nothing's going to happen. It's just a little tempest that's going to blow right on over, and it's going to be business as usual. I think the other important aspect of this is the torture report. Notice how the CIA wants to keep this thing super secret. And I think part of the reason they might feel like there's some criminal liability. I mean, look what's happening in South America, where you have democratic governments that are now putting and have been putting the torturers on trial under these military regimes. Military regimes, by the way, that were partnering with the CIA as part of what was called Operation Condor, that was an assassination torture program. No CIA officials have been brought to trial, even though their partners and their comrades in Latin America have been brought to trial and are now serving time. And I think that has to be lurking in the back of the minds of the CIA, that they know that what they've done, torture, waterboarding, and so forth, was illegal to the hilt. And I think they would love to keep that as secret as possible to avoid even the potential of having people call for criminal prosecution for these things.
Right. Well, and, you know, I think part of what must be scaring them, well, I mean, they know what's in there, but just the fact that it's 6,000 pages, 6,300 pages, it means the crowdsourcing of the Senate torture report, once it does get out in PDF format, where every blogger can, you know, every wannabe Marcy Wheeler can just have at those footnotes. I mean, you're talking about years. It's almost like the Snowden documents being released, right? It opens up the entire torture subject, and not just for the short term, but maybe, you know, for a long time, for long enough, like you're saying, to build up enough pressure that somebody might actually get in trouble for murdering somebody.
Yeah, and don't forget that, you know, the CIA, you know, this shows you how audacious they are, how arrogant they are, how powerful they are. They had recorded all these torture sessions, or many of the torture sessions, videotaped them. You know, how much fun is that, videotaping these sessions, so that you can apparently use these videotapes later on in torture class? And then when it all was brought to the surface and Congress starts to investigate it, what do they do? They destroy the videotape, knowing that this official investigation was going to be going on. And they did it intentionally. This wasn't like a routine destruction that we often hear them doing when there's an investigation pending. This was a deliberate obstruction of an investigation to avoid having to justify what they'd done with these videotapes. Did anything happen to that guy? Nothing. No prosecution, no indictment, nothing. Just, you know, not even a slap on the wrist.
Right. Well,
and it really goes
the
president to
show their arrogance. Barack Obama himself said, hey, we have to look forward, not back. We will not have accountability under the law for Bush regime torturers. That's as simple as that. All right, now, we got to take this break, but when we get back, we'll have more with Jacob Hornberger on the Senate and the CIA, torture and spying and the post-constitutional empire here on the Scott Horton Show, Liberty Express Radio. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org. Of course, Bovard, Richmond, Gregory, McElroy, and a bunch of great writers there at fff.org for you. And so now we're talking about, torture, spying, the rule of law, and the constitutional separations of powers and these kinds of things. And one of the things I thought was mildly ironic, Jacob, in this speech by Dianne Feinstein is she cites, first of all, the part of the Constitution which I forgot exactly what it's called, but the Protected Debate Clause, I think, is what they call it, where it says in, I believe, Article 1... or maybe it's in, I don't know which article it's in, but the Congress is protected from arrest for anything that they do on the Senate floor. So, like, when Mike Gravel read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record, you know, tough luck, Richard Nixon, you can't do anything about it because the Constitution protects him from arrest for doing something like that. And so she invoked that as part of, you know, the separation of powers doctrine being violated by the CIA here. But then she also said, hey, and this violates the Fourth Amendment, and it violates, this is Dianne Feinstein talking, on the question of being spied on over the torture report. It violates the Fourth Amendment, and she even invoked Executive Order 12,333, not the part that supposedly authorizes the NSA to do all these horrible things, but the part that supposedly forbids the CIA from spying or operating on American soil in any way against Americans, and how she ought to be protected against, you know, for those reasons, which, you know, I thought was hilarious, and she's their number one, you know, accessory to the crime there when it comes to NSA spying on all the rest of us.
That's a great point, Scott. I mean, it really demonstrates the hypocrisy of these people that, you know, she's all offended because the CIA is spying on her. But boy, she just doesn't bat an eyelash at the fact that the NSA, which is the sister organization in this National Security State branch of the government, is spying on all the rest of us. And who knows, the CIA could be spying on all of us, too. Nothing's going to happen to them if they do. We all know that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It's good to see her making the statement of outrage that you don't have the right to be spying on me and my staff and the members of Congress. How about a little bit of consideration for the American people? Because that's exactly how we feel.
Right.
And so, yeah, your point is well taken. It really demonstrates the double standards and the hypocrisy of these people.
Well, what's funny is, I mean, you got to figure, and I don't mean to a man, every single one of them, but for the most part, if you're a senator, you got that way because you're pretty corrupt and made some pretty bad compromises and put your personal ambition before any kind of principle anyway, or else how in the hell did you become a senator? So pretty much all these guys are compromisable. And then you got to remember now, we already know from the Snowden documents, we know that the NSA is spying on the Congress all the time, because that was in the story in The Guardian, the Greenwald story in The Guardian, that the New York Times never even mentioned and never made it to TV news here, but that they turn over their entire hall to Israel every day, and that they have a deal with the Israelis that promised not to read anything in there about or listen or you know, search any information that you have in there of our Congress people. So they already know that they're turning over everything they have, including on the Congress, to the Israelis. And then they're saying, oh, but please don't go digging through, you know, their corruption and their secrets. You know, that would, we could see how that wouldn't serve anyone's interests, right?
Well, and that's another factor here. You know, I mean, that's the reason governments spy on people and spy on members of Congress. That's what J. Edgar Hoover was famous for. You get information, you get dirt on people, and then they're not going to oppose you. And we cannot discount that possibility, given the fact that the NSA keeps track of everybody's phone calls. If any member of Congress is having an extramarital affair, and there's a bunch of phone calls to the person they're having the affair with, there's not any chance at all that that congressman is going to take on the NSA or the CIA and so forth. And that's the whole benefit of this surveillance scheme. That's why totalitarian regimes, communist regimes, spy on their citizens, not just to see what they're up to, but to be able to use blackmail and extortion to make sure that they don't get any opposition.
Right.
But I think,
well,
we,
like you're
have
saying
to...
too, it's the panopticon effect where they don't even try it because they don't know whether the NSA can prove they've been having an affair or not. But who wants to take that risk if you know you're guilty of something, you know?
Oh, there's no question about it. Once you know that you're doing something and they have evidence of that and you suspect it, you're not going to test them. You're just going to not make any waves at all.
Right.
And so you can't help but wonder whether that's one of the big reasons why the members of Congress never make waves against the CIA and the NSA. I mean, what's happening today is really remarkable. And I can't help but believe that it's a result of pressure from some of us in the press that have been saying, why are you so silent about this? You're an independent branch of government that the CIA is supposedly just an agency. And, well, we know it's not just an agency, and so I think it may be pressure. I think we should also raise, though, Scott, what's different about us libertarians is that we're not interested in just reining in the CIA or reining in the NSA like a lot of these liberals are. We're, and of course, the conservatives just want to expand the power. We libertarians want to dismantle this whole national security state apparatus. It was brought into existence. It was justified by the so-called Cold War against America's World War II partner and ally. Well, that Cold War ended in 89, and that national security state apparatus should have been dismantled, and instead we kept it in existence. We got all the terrorist attacks and the perpetual war on terrorism. We now have this crisis against Russia is a direct result of what NATO's been doing to expand its power into Eastern Europe. And now we have this torture scheme that's coming about. Well, you know, it just goes on and on. And I think it's now time for the American people to say, what is the role of government in our society? And start talking about dismantling this fourth branch rather than reforming it.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. And, you know, I'm more of a Richmondian on this, where I want to go back to at least the Articles of Confederation. Or maybe no. In fact, I kind of like that one because that just seems like maybe I could sell it in a million years that, hey, we can still be the USA, but without a general government in D.C. at all. It's proven to be, you know, too much. You give them an inch, they'll take a mile, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could be very happy to do the Articles of Confederation. But absent that, I mean, it's not an either-or thing. You can dismantle agencies. You can dismantle the DEA. You can legalize drugs. You can dismantle the welfare state and then see what's left, you know? I think there would be a tremendous, well, I know there'd be a tremendous sea change in America if you could get rid of the warfare state apparatus of the government and the welfare state apparatus and the drug war apparatus without even returning to the Articles of Confederation. Remember, these were things that our American ancestors for more than 100 years lived without. And if they lived without it, they showed that it's possible to live without these apparatuses. And Cold War is over. Get rid of this thing. All it's doing is creating problems for us. The newest problem is, you know, pledging the lives of American young people to defend Croatia, Turkey, Slovenia, Slovakia, Czech Republic. How many people realize that their brothers and sisters, well, maybe their sisters, brothers, sons, fathers have been pledged to the defense of these countries? It's incredible. Without even a congressional vote, without a treaty, it's incredible. Just by making them members of NATO.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all of our lives there, because when you're talking about Eastern Europe and NATO and possible conflict with Russia, that means the possibility of losing entire cities here back home in North America, where we're not used to having to fight our wars. You know, but by the way, I wanted to add something to what you're saying here about just how off course we are, because I think it's really hard sometimes for people to imagine a society where we don't have this massive military state, and they can't imagine. I mean, you think of all the hue and cry when they try to close one military base anywhere. People can't imagine just, you know, cutting the cord. But at that conference that you invited me to speak at on February the 15th there, which everybody can see the videos at fff.org. I got to have breakfast with you and Bob Higgs and others, and I asked Robert Higgs, the great libertarian economist, all about this. If I had the magical powers and I could just completely abolish the entire warfare state and all these people had to go get a real job tomorrow, how bad of a shock would it be? What would happen? And Higgs' attitude was, no problem. You know what? You abolish militarism. You stop distorting the economy into all of this militarism. We'll all be rich. And don't you worry one little bit about closing a base here or having some unemployed former infantrymen there. It'll all work out in the price system in no time.
Oh, it would be the greatest economic revival immediately that one can ever imagine. I mean, you know, you see this kind of phenomenon at the end of a war where some people say, oh, how can we discharge all these soldiers into the private sector? They're going to go increase unemployment. Well, the exact opposite happens. It's a doubly positive effect because now the private sector isn't having to pay for the taxes that fund these people. So they get to keep all that money in the private sector. And now these non-productive people are in the private sector producing wealth themselves. So it's doubly positive. And if you dismantle the entire draining force of the warfare state on America, it would be unbelievably fantastic.
There you go. You see, everybody, it does not have to be this way. Go to FFF.org and read Jacob Hornberger and his great stable of writers there and figure out how to put liberty first here for a change. Thank you very much, Jacob. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, everybody. FFF.org. And please do check out the great videos of all the great speeches, including mine and John Glazer's there at the conference there back February the 15th. That's at their YouTube channel there as well. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And man, this is going to be too much like a time warp back to 10 years ago. I got Dar Jamail on the phone. Luckily, he's not in Iraq. He's in Qatar. And reporting for Truthout. The latest is Iraqi government killing civilians in Fallujah. You see what I mean? About just like a long time ago. Welcome back to the show, Dar. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Very good to have you here. And, man, well, I guess, let us have it. Tell us your story here.
Yeah, you're right. It is, unfortunately, too much like a time warp here, except instead of the U.S. military directly attacking Fallujah, shelling people, engaging in collective punishment like not allowing medical supplies into the city, more civilians being killed than fighters. We are all too familiar with that story. I've talked with you about it on air right here. But instead of the U.S. military, it's the Maliki government and sort of to a certain extent by proxy for the U.S. military, because it's the U.S. government that's been rushing arms to Maliki to use against the people in Fallujah since this crisis took a turn to the much more violent just starting this past January. But that's essentially what's happened. I mean, overall, we had a situation where the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, a small contingent of them moved into the city and started fighting against Maliki's government forces there alongside people inside the city, more generalized resistance forces that had been taking up arms against the Maliki government as a result of failed demands being met. Let me just backtrack a little bit here first. Sure. Starting back in late 2012, I know that you're aware of this, Scott, because Annie Wars reported on this extensively as it was going on. But starting in late 2012, there started to be a massive ongoing protest every Friday, oftentimes blocking the highway that goes between Baghdad and Amman, Jordan. It runs right in front of Fallujah. So people in Anbar, and specifically in Fallujah and Ramadi, would gather there during Friday prayers to do their prayers and then have a protest against the government, because the government, they were accusing them of coming in, conducting home detentions, taking people, suspected fighters, et cetera, literally doing the exact same thing that the U.S. military used to do in Fallujah, simply because these people were in opposition to some of Maliki's sectarian tactics in the government in Baghdad. And so he was retaliating by targeting people in Anbar province, because that's where most of the resistance was coming from.
again, conducting home raids, bringing people into prisons, torturing people, raping people, both men and women. And this was rampant all across Anbar and parts of Baghdad where Maliki was meeting resistance as well. Again, it's if we just replace Maliki with U.S. forces and back up 10 years, it's basically the same story. But those protests were going on all through 2013, none of the demands being met, the situation continuing to worsen. Maliki's army started opening fire on demonstrators, killing people from time to time in various places around Anbar province, sometimes in Baghdad. And then it really hit a crescendo this past January when overt fighting broke out and resistance fighters started to open attacks on the Maliki government forces, kicking them out of Ramadi, kicking them out of Fallujah. That's when ISIS slipped in and joined the fight. And then, of course, Maliki basically started waving the terrorist flag and saying, look, once again, Al-Qaeda has taken control of Fallujah, just like when you guys were here saying this to the Obama administration, we need some more arms here pronto. So in addition to the already $20 billion of weaponry and training that the U.S. government has provided Maliki, who's basically now looked upon by many in Iraq as a Shia Saddam, they upgraded even more weapons and missiles to ship to him, to rush ship to him, to use starting this past January on the people of Fallujah. And so we have a situation now, again, resembling much what happened in 2004 that you and I talked about regarding the U.S. military. The Iraqi government has circled Fallujah. They can't get into the city, so they're shelling it on a daily basis. And once again, we have a situation where clearly the majority of the people being killed are civilians. I spoke with Dr. Ahmed Shami, the chief of resident doctors at Fallujah General Hospital, and he told me last week that up to then, and these numbers are going to be a little bit out of date now because these are about a week old, but up to that point, he said there were at least 109 civilians that had been killed and 632 that were wounded. And then of those, at least 10 of the dead were children. Another 40 of the wounded were children. And then as far as women goes, at least 5 of the dead were women and 35 of the wounded were also women.
Wow. So part of this story is about the success of terrorism. It always seems to work for what we used to call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, this tiny percentage of the Sunni insurgency, the Zarqawiites. Now they call themselves the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as you said. And all they got to do is hoist the black flag, fire an AK-47 in the air a couple of times, and provoke a massive violent clampdown, or at least create the excuse, right, for the Maliki government, the Shiite Baghdad government, to clamp down and drive more people into their cause, which is, at this point now, it's much more focused on fighting Assad, I think, than fighting Maliki. They already kind of lost the war to Maliki a few years back, but they can at least provoke Maliki into driving up their recruitment as they head west. And, of course, it's good politics for Maliki, too, to say, hey, I'm the leader of the Shiites, protecting the Shiites from the Sunnis, because he wasn't going to get the Sunni votes anyway, right? To misparaphrase James Baker about F them, they don't vote for us either way. So
that's accurate, Scott. I mean, that really is, in a nutshell, politically the rough sketch of what's going on. And that's why we've seen these clashes from inside of Iraq bleed up to the borders with Syria. And we've seen Iraqi military guys killed up on the border of Syria by these ISIS fighters, and then that going into Syria. And we have literally Sunni fighters pouring into Syria to take on that fight, as well as then Shia militias going up into Syria as well to back the Assad regime. So we already have an intra-country war in that respect, and this is basically one facet of it. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, the tragedy of it is that, just like you said, we have a small number of these ISIS guys come into Fallujah, literally did just as you described, raise a black flag. They were within minutes told by the tribal leaders in the city, who really are the people in control of the city, just like when the Americans were sieging it, said, look, no, that's not going to fly. You're not running the show here. Get those flags down. They were down less than 5 minutes after they were raised. They were put properly in their place, and that just shows who's in charge. But then, of course, that gives the Maliki government carte blanche, according to them anyway, to encircle the city. They're not letting any medical supplies in, according to Dr. Shami, and they've been shelling it every day since. Some of the other doctors I spoke with in there, one on condition of anonymity, and this doctor had actually had to flee the city because her neighborhood was being shelled so heavily. She said mosques were being targeted. I have a photo in the story that I wrote for Truth Out from Dr. Shami of the outside of Fallujah General Hospital. Shells have landed nearby the hospital. The hospital itself has taken shrapnel from those shellings, and you can see that in one of the photos that I posted. And this is the great tragedy. So we have a hospital, at least one main hospital has been shelled, several mosques. We have civilians being killed. The shelling continues. And to date, from Fallujah, it's an estimated 300,000 people. So the majority of the people of Fallujah have once again had to flee their city. That's about almost the exact same number that had to flee during the U.S. sieges in 2004. And then if we look at Al Anbar province more broadly, bringing Ramadi into the mix, which isn't too far from Fallujah, there's also a lot of ongoing fighting there, and we have another approximately 100,000 people who've been displaced there. So once again, we have a massive displacement of people within Al Anbar province, tribal leaders calling for the Maliki government to back off, just let people go home. We've got to get relief supplies in there. But once again, the Maliki government is just keeping the city encircled and continuing with the shelling. Really, at least, unfortunately, as of right now, we don't see an end in sight.
Oh, man. It's such a mess. And, all right, well, when we get back from the break, I want to backtrack a little bit to something Ray McGovern said in a speech the other day about the beginning of the war in Fallujah back 10 years ago in the spring of 2004, the first battle of Fallujah and Najaf at the same time, of course. And then the major battle of Fallujah, the one that people remember the most, was right after the election of 2004 in November there. And I seem to remember, Dar, learning from you the cause and effect. And we went down the chain and explained, you really explained on the show back years ago about how much that had played into precipitating the civil war that took hold after the election and the Constitution and the rise of the Iraq United Alliance and all that. So more with Dar Jamail at truthout.org when we get back. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Saddam Hussein no longer fills fields with remains of innocent men, women, and children. Because we acted, Saddam's torture chambers and rape rooms and children's prisons have been closed for good.
Ah, reopened. Under new management, the Dawa Party in the form of Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister of Iraq. All right, so now we can talk all about, I want to hear all about the current casualties and any of that you want to prioritize. I'll really let you, Dar, but I was hoping I could hear from you about how, you know, the entire war was a disaster from beginning to end. Nobody would ever justify any part of it, I don't think, not anymore. But it did not have to be quite as horrible as it was. And I remember you explaining about how the original attack on Fallujah generated so many refugees that they ended up generating more refugees where they landed, and then those refugees generated some more refugees where they ended up, and how in the lead up to the voting on the Constitution and the voting for who was going to rule the parliament and all of that, how this had really helped solidify all of the enemy sides, in time for the vote to make it all that much worse, which I hope I didn't just tell the whole story. But anyway, and then also, if you could, I would have you talk about the surge and the benchmarks, which were supposed to include, the so-called victory that makes the Iraq War anything but a defeat for America somehow, is that David Petraeus saved the day. But the deal was he was supposed to integrate. Maliki was supposed to allow the Sunni tribal leaders and whoever, their political representation, into the government and have a, you know, multi-party democracy kind of thing going forward here and all of that. And you know how well that worked out, and especially in terms of the protest movement and the renewed civil war that you've been describing here. And now I'll be quiet and turn the mic over to you.
Well, yeah, that's a lot, Scott. I mean, there's so much there to discuss. I mean, I'll start with the point that you ended with, and then hit a couple of other things that you brought up that I think are really important to what's going on in Fallujah right now, and start with the SAWA forces, the so-called awakening forces that you were just speaking of, that the U.S. basically went in. It was part of the so-called surge in 2007, and really, in reality, what they did is, that was even more important than injecting 30,000 more troops into Iraq, was they reconstituted an old strategy of Saddam, which is what he used to keep things under control in Anbar province, which was find certain tribal leader sheikhs who would do business with him, basically pay them millions of dollars to get them then to distribute that money out to people under their power and control, and basically pay off their fighters to lay low and don't attack the big man in charge, and let's try to keep things fairly copacetic. That's essentially how that played out, and that's exactly what the U.S. did. They went out, they found which sheikhs would play ball with them. They started funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into them. One of these, Sheikh Afan, was a man, actually a Saudi man, who was part Iraqi, who came back in to Iraq in 2006 and basically posed as a native Fallujah man, a sheikh in power, and came in, took the U.S. money, quickly put together, cobbled together with that money, a 900-man militia under his command, bought a real nice palace on the outskirts of Fallujah, built up the walls, put a bunch of machine gun emplacements in it, and became the SAWA leader in charge of Fallujah until he was then assassinated. And that's how this has run its course, where the U.S. basically propped these guys up, so that these guys would start taking more of the hit than the U.S. military was. And it was fairly effective at a time. It's splintering off some of the resistance movement who went with the SAWA forces, took the money, until then the U.S. Left them high and dry. And then, of course, as you just said, Maliki broke his promises. Hey, we're going to take these 100,000 guys. We're going to incorporate them into the Iraqi military. We're going to give them jobs, pay them, get these folks representation within the government. None of that happened. These guys started not being paid immediately, and the U.S. left them hung out to dry. And then now what we're left with is these SAWA forces, some of them still aligning themselves with Maliki's army. A few of them have gotten jobs. The majority of still have not. Yet they still often are being targeted. And you look at the anti-war, Jason Ditch's daily updates on what's going on in Iraq. Every other day you're going to see SAWA guys that are being taken out and or with their families. And that is continuing to this day. So these guys are there, and they're still being taken out. And they will be, because they're being seen by the majority of people in the Iraqi resistance as collaborators, which for the most part the majority of them are. And that, of course, is just one level of this very complex situation as to how and why Iraq is the absolute train wreck that it is today. And then going backwards, just, quick history, something that you brought up right before the break. You mentioned Ray McGovern's talk and really talking about what got the ball rolling in Fallujah, because so many people think it's when the Blackwater guys were caught there, and the four of them were killed, and the bodies burned and hung from the bridge on March 31, 2004. But we could go back to the beginning of the invasion, but even just backing up a little over a week before that date, we can look at what happened in the Gaza Strip at the hands of the Israeli military, where on March 22, 2004, Sheikh Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, was assassinated by an Israeli missile. And that then created conditions in Fallujah where what formed up in Fallujah at the time was a Sheikh Yassin Revenge Brigade. And when the four Blackwater guys were killed on March 31st, actually, I believe it was AP had reported at the time that the people who killed the Blackwater guys, who claimed responsibility, called themselves the Sheikh Yassin Revenge Brigades. And they did it out of revenge for the Israeli assassination of Sheikh Yassin. They spread flyers around the scene of where they killed the Blackwater guys. Some of the flyers were hung on the backs of trucks and some in some of the nearby shops. They had warned people of the attack was coming, so that's why the streets were relatively empty. And then when the Blackwater guys came through and they knew they were coming, they were ready for them. And so we can actually, at least in that time frame, you could argue fairly confidently that the entire situation of Fallujah, the spark that lit the fire, was actually lit by the Israeli military in Gaza on March 22nd. So yet another example, as you know, Scott, you've covered this on your show with myself and many other guests over the years, that, you know, when the Israeli military beats its wings in Gaza, the echoes go across the entire Middle East. And here is one very bloody example of how Israeli policy literally led to the lives of, well, some private security contractors for starters, but then hundreds of dead U.S. soldiers as a result of Israeli foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then can you talk a little bit about the blowback from especially the second attack on Fallujah in November 2004 and the refugees and all that? Because, you know, it seemed like that was what really gave the suicide bomber resistance, rather than tribal sheiks trying to negotiate the upper hand from the Sunni point of view, was all the conflict that was generated from that. I mean, again, you can always go back to you know what? History is going to always go back to the original sin of the invasion of March 03, like Bush's Woodrow Wilson or something. I mean, boy, did you not have to do that stupid to set all these horrible dominoes falling and knocking each other over and leading to all of this conflict. We can always go back to that. But specifically, he also did not have to send the Marines into Fallujah the way he did. He was just proving what a tough guy he was. In fact, remember General Sanchez reproduced Bush's little pep talk. This is a moment, and so we have to bomb them and go save democracy and whatever. He told the generals to go in there and just blast the hell out of everything to prove that we are the winners here. And then what happened, Dar?
That's exactly right, Scott. I mean, that whole time period was, it was really insane. I mean, it was a lesson in hubris. I mean, again, as you were going through some of this earlier, you know, it was just before when the U.S. election happened in 2004, already the decision had been made to invade Fallujah. Of course, not everybody on the ground was aware of that, least of all the people on the negotiating team in the city of Fallujah. Mohammed al-Daraji, he's actually one of the doctors I quoted in the article I wrote last week about what's going on in Fallujah, because he helped found an aid NGO operating in the city. He was actually on the negotiating team of leaders in the city, tribal sheikhs, doctors, et cetera, aid workers, who were in negotiations with people in the U.S. military, and they thought they were good faith negotiations. They still thought and hoped that there was a way to ward off this massive siege. They knew that it would result in hundreds, if not thousands, of casualties, which it did, mostly civilians. And so up until the last minute, they were negotiating in good faith and still thinking maybe we were going to be able to avert this. And, of course, the on-the-ground leaders of the U.S. military were hoping it could be averted for obvious reasons. But then, of course, the election happened, and then they gave it a few days. And then on November 8th, out of nowhere, which surprised everybody in the negotiations, at least on the Iraqi side, Iyad Alawi, the former CIA asset, who was at the time the interim prime minister of Iraq, who the U.S. had put in place conveniently, said, okay, I am giving the green light for the siege, as though he had any power to instruct the U.S. military what to do. Mm-hmm. So we, of course, know exactly where that order came from. You just had touched on it by playing the nice early recording to remind us all of the pleasant former President Bush. of where that order came from. So the city was sieged. Duraji's NGO estimated upwards of 5,000 casualties, the majority of them civilians. And then as a result, yeah, we had 300,000-plus refugees, many of whom to date have never been able to go back home, either because of
Can you stay another 10 minutes, Dar? I hate to just cut you off here for the break, but I got to take it. Can you stay another 10?
Sure thing.
Okay, great. It's Dar Jamail, everybody. Truthout.org. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. I'm on the phone with Dar Jamail. I really should have given him a better introduction at the beginning of this thing. Dar reported on the Iraq War from at least nearly the beginning, for years and years, from Iraq as an unembedded reporter, and he wrote at least a couple of books about it. And I'm sorry, I don't remember your whole bio off the top of my head anymore, bud, but I can tell you that this guy, he was there. He's not just telling you what he read about Iraq or what he learned from talking to somebody who was there like me. He was there. He's the guy I was talking to who I learned this stuff from in the first place. And so, you know, I'm really happy to have the opportunity to give him a chance to talk to you guys today. So I do want to get back to current events and, you know, whether there's any hope of peace here or we're just going to have an unending Sunni Shia Arab civil war from now on because of George Bush or what. But first of all, you were telling the history of the blowback from that, I guess, Siege 2 of Fallujah in November 04, especially there, Dar.
Yeah, so where we left off is that, you know, we had several hundred thousand people displaced from that siege who still haven't gone home. And this is a province, Anbar province, where Fallujah is, the large western province. And this is where the brunt of the resistance has come from against the U.S. military when the occupation was ongoing. And then now against the Maliki regime, because we have once again, a government set up where there's a large portion of the population, and in this case now it's the minority Sunnis, who really don't have adequate representation in the government. The Shia, it's a government basically set up to fail, and the U.S. designed it and put it there and left it there in place, set it up along sectarian lines, knowing that this was going to happen. And you know, we're looking now at a situation in Iraq where it's such a bloodbath. It's so unstable, and there's really no end in sight as far as what is a solution, what's in reality, in the geopolitical reality of the situation, what's really going to need to happen. There's no chance for it to happen because, again, we can trace so much of this back to the U.S. And so much of the things that you and I, Scott, talked about over the years, like back in 2004 when they brought in John Negroponte to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Negroponte,
the El Salvador option.
Exactly, who brought in retired Colonel James Steele to set up death squads in Iraq, again, sectarian-based death squads, pulling them from the Mahdi Army and the Badr Brigades, you know, the two bigger, more well-armed and funded Shia militias, and then sending them out literally to hunt Sunnis. So all these sectarian-based policies, the, you know, the tit-for-tat killings along sectarian lines, the political lines drawn, again, along sectarian lines, and this is what's created the conditions for what is current present-day Iraq, where there's, of course, you know, goes without saying, nothing like democracy, nothing like equal representation and any kind of a real power balance within the government. You have literally Maliki, who's come in, has created his own secret service, his own private militias, his own torture dungeons, and is basically running the government as such, as a Shia Saddam, as a Shia dictator. And so essentially the U.S., they switched horses. You know, Saddam wasn't playing ball the way they wanted him to play ball anymore. After playing ball with him quite happily for a couple of decades, So they went in, invaded the country, replaced them, went through a couple of other previous guys who had dictator potential, Alawi being one of them, and then settling, we'll go with Maliki. He seems to be playing ball with us. And so that's what we have. We've got them now riding the Maliki horse. They've already donated $20 billion in arms and training, as I said earlier. And now we have the bloodbath. That's, in general, why we have the bloodbath that we do in Iraq today. And really, unfortunately, the great tragedy is I really don't see a solution. I mean, not one that would actually occur in practicality on the ground. There's no solution in sight. The U.S. is absolutely not going to get directly involved again. There's no way that's going to happen. And so instead, they're just going to keep funneling in arms, and there's no indication that they're going to stop doing that into Maliki while he's carrying out these draconian military missions against people in Al-Anbar and on a smaller scale around parts of Baghdad.
Right. Well, what's funny, too, man, if you go back and think about it, if we had just cut and run back in 2004, I mean, nobody knows exactly what would have happened, but the Shiite parties, the United Iraqi Alliance, the Dawa, the Skiri, and Sadr, that alliance, they would have had so much more incentive to negotiate with the Sunnis and come to some kind of settlement without us there. But as long as they had us, it was really, that was the success of the surge, if it was anything, was finishing up the complete sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, or not complete, but it's about an 85 or 90% Shiite Arab city now, because they were able to get the U.S. infantry and the U.S. Marine Corps to fight that war for them. But and remember, all the excuses were, no, we can't cut and run now because the violence will get worse. The violence will get worse. But if we left then, there would have been much more incentive for the Shiites to compromise. Now, since the Americans helped them take the capital city and everything, now they can just tell the Sunnis, screw off. We don't have to share any of the oil money with you. We don't have to share any of the resources with you. We don't have to do anything for you. We already won. You already lost. So what are you going to do about it? And that's where they're at now. So I'm not saying it would have been perfect. Never should have invaded at all. But, just thinking back on all of the bogus arguments and catchphrases and slogans of the war party that kept us in that war all those years, how fake they all were, how many people knew better back then. Even Sadr wanted in 04 to join an alliance with the insurgent tribes in Fallujah and say, let's have a nationalist Arab allied government against the Iranians and the Americans both. And, of course, the Americans vetoed that and ended up turning over the South to the Iranians and getting their asses kicked out back in 2011.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think that it's a solid argument that if the U.S. had withdrawn, then Iraq would definitely be in better shape today, because it would have been a more level playing field politically, and all sides would have really had no choice to try to work things out more diplomatically, as opposed to now. It really did play out in large part as you described. The U.S. stayed in there, continued the power imbalance, favoring Maliki and his cohort, and so now there's this massive imbalance. And it's really amazing, because I mean, I was in Fallujah a year ago this month. And I remember I went to one of these Friday demonstrations, and I interviewed one of the leading sheikhs of that demonstration on that day, a guy named Sheikh Khalid Hamoud al-Jumaili. Jumaili tribe is very, very strong in Fallujah. And he said, look, what Maliki's doing is wrong. They're dividing us. He's kidnapping us. He's displacing us. We're making these demands, basically, which is just to have our basic core human rights respected. We've been making these demands peacefully for months, and what's he do? He keeps coming in, and now he's starting to kill us when we're having nonviolent protests on a highway for 2 hours a week, and they're not being met. And this was as far back as last March. The protests I went to, they were calling it Last Chance Friday, because they were saying, look, this is it. If they don't meet our demands now, then I don't know. We might have to start fighting. And that's what he told me on that day. Well, they went another 9 months almost without starting to fight back against the Maliki army. It's amazing that they stayed peaceful for that long. I think it's a testament to their intentions, that they really didn't want things to devolve into this level of violence. But then push came to shove, and you'd only kill so many dozens of protesters, and eventually the sheikhs aren't going to be able to control the fighters under them, and then you have a new wave of resistance against the government, and then that's what we're looking at now. They can't punch into Fallujah because the fighting is too fierce, so they just surround it and shell it and keep tightening the noose around what supplies they let into the city, medical supplies or otherwise. And that's what we have now. So we do. We have, what's devolved into essentially a civil war largely along sectarian lines. And as we just talked about, you can trace the causes of this right back to the exploiting the sectarian lines and the very sectarian, the biased sectarian policies of the U.S. military and government while the occupation was going on. But this was set up, I think, clearly by design, just like the government in Lebanon is set up to where there's always going to be a massive power imbalance, and that way no one's ever going to really be able to get, we're not going to have a truly representative stable government, and that's what we have in Iraq, and that's why, you know, with short, massive, radical changes on the ground, starting with getting rid of Maliki and his regime and having some real elections, because, you know, remember, he lost the last election against the Yed Lowy, where he literally didn't even win the majority of the votes, and here he sits as prime minister.
Right. Which is amazing, because Alawi, as you said, he was the former CIA truck bomber sock puppet in 2004, and people even preferred him to Maliki by then, but Maliki was able to retain power. Now, part of that then, though, also was that in January of 2004, the Ayatollah Sistani said, we want one man, one vote. None of this Paul Bremer design caucus system. And he said, if you're a Shiite and you believe in God, I want you to go outside and demand one man, one vote. So all the Shiites went outside and said, you want to start this war over again, Bush? And he said no. And so at that point, you know, the best they could do was the disaster to come.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And it was amazing because I was in Baghdad when that happened, and he called for those demonstrations, and they were the single biggest demonstrations I have ever witnessed in my life. I mean, it was as though, at that time, Baghdad wasn't as predominantly Shia as it is now, but even then, there were well over a million people. I mean, the entire capital city was shut down. There were just masses of people in the streets, any direction you looked, and all the Bush administration could do is have the military fly a bunch of helicopters around taking pictures of them and talking on their walkie-talkies,
right,
which we were listening in on at the time, and that's all they could do. And they knew at that point, yeah, I think we better back down. I don't think we have enough troops on the ground to deal with this if we piss Sistani off, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I mean, remember, David Wilmser and Richard Pearl thought they were going to get a Hashemite sock puppet king like in Jordan, or if not that, maybe Ahmed Chalabi, to be loyal and install an AEI policy the whole time. That whole fantasy fell apart, I think, on day two of the invasion. But, the chaos, you know, rages on. Now, where else can we find you? You're still at DarjamilIraq.com or what?
The website's gone through some iterations. It's DarJamil.net.
Okay,
I am reporting now full-time with Truth Out, so I do intend to continue writing more stories on what's happening in Iraq.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you back, Dar. Thank you so much for your time.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. That is Dar Jamil, darjamil.net, and now he is writing for Truth Out, truthout.org. This one is called Iraqi Government Killing Civilians in Fallujah. Sad story as the consequences of America's war continue to rage on there. We'll be right back. I got Ukraine and other news in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, man, it was funny. I was on Alan Butler's show earlier this morning. And then I was back on the show again, only this time with my old friend Charles Goyette as well. And we carried on complaining about the media for a while. And it was just hilarious, Alan talking about, yeah, but they got her on tape plotting the coup. I mean, how can they not talk about that? You know, the media. They just don't talk about it. They just, hey, history began the day that the Russians invaded Crimea. You know, without a shot being fired. No casualties as of yet. Could be some, but you don't need to know anything that happened before that. Russia bad. Saddam Hussein, Hitler, Noriega, Emmanuel Goldstein. Throw your shoe at the picture of him on your TV and yell and scream and know that you're on the side of the angels. Anyway, truth of the matter is, yeah, no, the American, basically ambassador to the European Union, the Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, was busted, caught on tape plotting a coup in Ukraine. Here it is, Victoria Nuland. This is not the whole thing. It's some clips I got. You can find the whole thing at YouTube. No problem. It's about 4 minutes long. Or is it six? I think it's four. Anyway, it's Victoria Nuland. And she's on the phone with Jeffrey Pyatt, the American ambassador to Ukraine. And they are plotting a coup. And again, this is the F the EU leak. But the only reason she's effing the EU is because they're moving too slow and ineffectively on her regime change. She's not mad at them for siding with the Russians. She's mad at them for not being good enough at getting this thing done. And so that's the context of the conversation, how to go ahead and get this thing put together here. And so all TV had to say about it was, oh, boo-hoo, someone said the F word, and oh, boo-hoo, the Russians are tapping our phones. I mean, the nerve.
The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tawny Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
All right, so there you go. That's four clips from the Victoria Nuland conversation. Just put Nuland in Google, and the first thing will come up is the YouTube of this. In fact, look for a longer version of it. You might find shorter versions of it. Find the whole thing if you want and listen. And basically, they're just talking. It's not even too hard to keep up with the names. They're talking about Klitschko. That's the former boxer. And they're talking about Yatsenyuk. I'm sorry, I can never say these guys' names right. She calls him Yats. Yeah, the guy we want is Yats. He's the one who's going to do what he's told. Yats, the former central banker. Yats, oh, the guy who's now the prime minister of Ukraine in the new post-coup d'etat government there. just so you know, history did not begin with the Russian invasion of Crimea, which, of course, by the way, belonged to Russia long before the Soviet Union, belonged to Russia for 200 years, and Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine back when Ukraine was part of the USSR, and it didn't really matter anyway. He was a Ukrainian. And it is, after all, connected to Ukraine, but it is, after all, a giant peninsula that sticks out, and it's a very small hop to Russia, just right there. I don't even know how long the bridge is, but it's just a bridge that connects it to Russia, in the little, what you call it, strait there. But anyway, so, you know, this is not to excuse the existence of the Russian state in any way, actually. They don't have the right to exist and be a state. Nobody has the right to be a state. The hell is this, Russia? Putin has no right to be the boss of anybody. I don't care if he's elected or not. But anyway, I'm not trying to justify Russia, the existence of its state, or any action taken by the Russian government. I'm not excusing morally anything. What I am saying is the Americans had every right to assume, had every reason to understand that if they push too hard to change the regime in Ukraine again, just like they did 10 years ago, then what would happen would be, well, really, I guess 9 years ago, or right around, that, you know, one possibility would be that Russia would move a chess piece too. And they would say, okay, but we are going to go ahead and solidify and consolidate our influence in Crimea. Now, at this point, what's happened is the Crimean government, which they already had semi-autonomy, like a separate, you know, kind of a province within Ukraine, and they had their own legislature, their own parliament, although not their own president anymore. But it's been in a state of flux since the fall of the Soviet Union regardless. Well, they voted, they want to rejoin Russia. And the Russian parliament has voted to allow it. Now, I think the final decision is still up to Putin and Russia and to a referendum that they mean to hold in Crimea. But they're 60% ethnic Russians and put in this position under, you know, the influence of their political leadership. It seems pretty certain. Oh, I don't know. It seems highly likely or something that Crimea will, in fact, rejoin Russia. But that's not going to change that much on the ground, because Crimea is just a big freaking Russian military base anyway, to a great degree. Well, no, not really. I mean, there's a lot of people who live there, but not that much is going to change as far as that goes. And listen, Robert Gates, Bush Jr. and Obama's Secretary of Defense, he said, hey, forget Crimea. It's over. Cut it loose. You lost it. Big deal. Don't worry about it. Don't be mad at Obama for losing it either, you know. And that's what I like to hear from former secretaries of war, that, you know what, this is a loss we can take. And now, I don't know if he went on to say, you know, worse things about, you know, red lines here or there. You know, what I think is that in Ukraine, they ought to have the most minimal state that has no right, has no authority to enter into a trade agreement with the EU or the Russians that has any detail other than no tariffs here, no tariffs there, if anything, at all. So we wouldn't have these problems. Of course, the Russians said, you can have a trade deal with both of us. The Americans were the ones who said, no, you have to choose one side or the other. And as Ted Snyder, I think he made a pretty convincing case that the Americans were deliberately making Yanukovych an offer that he could not accept. That, listen, you have to do this deal with the EU, but you're so, and their finances are in terrible shape over there. But what's going to happen is you're going to sign one of these, you know, the bad kind of IMF deals where the West runs off with all your resources. And a lot of times just liquidates them and destroys them and, you know, cashes in for short-term gain. It writes you off because what do they care about you kind of thing, the way the IMF preys on these weaker countries. And they were going to mandate that he commit complete and total political suicide inside Russia, and he refused to go along with it. He was the Russian-leaning guy in the first place. He's the guy that they coup d'etat him and stole his election back in 2004 with the big fake look-what-they-did-to-my-face thing by Yushchenko, who poisoned himself and tried to pretend that the FSB did it and played the victim in the Orange Revolution. And you know, apparently, so with from Ted Snyder's take, they didn't even want Yanukovych to be the one to sign the EU deal. They wanted to provoke him into, you know, they wanted to make him have to refuse to accept it and to tilt back toward Russia. And then, you know, step B would be when the protests break out over it, because there are a lot of people invested in that and invested in a Western-leaning future. After all, Ukrainians got a lot of great reasons to hate the Russians if they want to, for the things that the Soviet government had done to them and that kind of thing in history. But then they could just take advantage of those protests and do a coup. And that's ultimately what they did. And I would recommend to you again, Ted Snyder, our guest from yesterday on the show, this piece that he wrote for antiwar.com, Ukraine and 21st Century Coups. And he just explains how it's done. And, of course, this is not to hurt anyone's feelings and say that no one in Ukraine wanted to overthrow Yanukovych. I'm sure he was a horrible leader. He was a politician. If he was favored by the Americans, the Germans, or the Russians, that makes him the devil, right? I mean, come on. He's a sock puppet of somebody's oligarchs. None of this is to justify, you know, his political power, or even the Ukrainian state, for that matter, or its control by anybody. There are a lot of people who wanted to see him go, but those people they lost the election last time, and this time they weren't willing to wait. And now sometimes that's okay. I mean, you know, who am I to say that it's wrong for the people of Ukraine to want to go ahead and overthrow their government and not wait till the next scheduled election? It's their country, and these politicians are scum and have no, you know, actual right over them. Whatever authority the people have granted them, and even that's obviously under the entirely dubious theory of popular sovereignty and social contract theory and all this nonsense that somehow, what somebody call it, social magic theory, magic or pixie dust or something that makes us supposedly real. If they want to overthrow him, fine. If they want to put his head on a pike, fine. But the problem with that is when you're a minor power and you're stuck between the Americans and the Russians, then what ends up happening is your local protest movement is really just a front for the great game as waged by others. In this case, mostly over the future of military basing rights and the directions of oil and natural gas pipelines. And now I realize that I'm over time and I've got to go. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the show. That's it. I'll be back here tomorrow from 3 to 5 Eastern Time. ScottHorton.org, LibertyExpressRadio.com.